The Holy Gospel according to Mark. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue, called Jairus, came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her, so that she may be made well and live." He went with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. For she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha cum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. This is the gospel of Christ.
I can't compete with a plan. In the name of the Holy and Undivided Trinity, amen. Good morning. And welcome to St. Margaret's. It's a joy to see all of you today. I remember probably 2 or 3 years ago, I began a sermon. I even remember what the reading was. It was about Abraham looking out and counting the stars at night. And I quoted from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and I thought, I wonder if they'll know the line that follows. And I said, "The stars at night are big and bright," and the congregation got it. They knew just the line. I'm going to try a different movie this time and see if you can get it. Okay? I'll feed you the line. "You can't..." No, wait, I know. Okay, scratch that. Pretend I blew that. Okay. Let's just hope at the podcast they edit that part out. Okay? Here's the line. "I want the truth." Thank you. Okay. Dang. I can't get this right for anything. Okay. Yeah, you're right. It's You Can't Handle the Truth. It's an exchange during the movie A Few Good Men. My family loves that movie so much that we've watched it over and over and over. The only way we could stop ourselves from watching it again and again was finally to buy it. And then that pretty much was the end of our watching of the movie. But we've watched it so many times that I think I know most of the lines by heart. And that scene between Jack Nicholson the other guy, Tom Cruise, boy. See, and this was going to be the good one because I messed up a little bit at 9. This was going to be the cleanup sermon. Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson had been arguing with each other very bitterly in an important and contentious case. Cruise represented a couple of Marines who had been accused of murder, and he knew that they weren't guilty, that they had instead been put up to it by this character played by Jack Nicholson. But getting him to admit that he had anything to do with it looked hopeless. There was virtually no chance. So most of the movie is their hand-wringing about how defeat is certain. And in the course of it, people die over this. And you just think, this can't possibly work. The only hope is that Cruise could bait Nicholson and appeal to his vanity enough that he would finally just blurt it out and admit his guilt. And that was unlikely to happen because Nicholson may be many things, but he was not stupid. And so it didn't look good. But in this moment, in this heated exchange, finally Cruise baits him one more time. And finally, Nicholson yells out and admits it. And no one in the movie and no one in the theater expected that to happen. And so Cruise's character is so flummoxed that he just kind of stands there sputtering. He doesn't know what to say. And finally begins saying, "The witness has rights. The witness has rights." In that moment, instead of claiming triumph, instead of just declaring victory and saying, "Now I've got you," instead of gloating, instead of a painful triumphalism, there was just a sense of the humanity of his adversary. Whatever wretched a person Jack Nicholson may have been in this movie, all of a sudden, in the moment of triumph, Cruise came and saw that this was a human being, worthy of his care, worthy of his consideration, and worthy of his compassion. And that's kind of what's going on in our first reading today from the second book of Samuel. If this is your first Sunday with us in Carnes Hall, you may not know that we're on a sermon series right now. Instead of preaching from the Gospel of Mark as we normally would during this season, we've been preaching from that first reading that is a series of readings about the life of King David. And if you've been following along with the notes in the bulletin to tell you how far along to read in Scripture, you know that a whole lot has happened since the last time when our own David preached. Last time it was the story of David and Goliath. But in the meantime, a lot of other events have occurred. When I preached a couple of weeks ago, I said, well, it may be the case that God has anointed David, but that is not the same thing as saying he's now king, because there is already a living king who expects to be king himself, and that is Saul. And Saul was also God's anointed at one time, and so David didn't take this lightly, but neither did Saul. And Saul was going to go to the mat. He was not going to lose his kingship. He was going to do whatever it took to preserve it, including go into a bloody, bitter war to preserve everything that he had. Saul had a son named Jonathan who was dear to him, and Jonathan loved his father and was faithful to his father to the bitter end and died with him on the holy mountain up in the highlands. Jonathan was faithful to his father, but he was also faithful to his friend David. And he was faithful both because of his love for David and because he knew that David was in fact God's choice and God's anointed. And he knew that God's will had to be done. And so David, who you'll recall was a musician, wrote a lot of music, including our psalms that were originally set to music. He wrote a lot of music in the readings that we're reading from right now, including this first reading we heard just now. It's a lament of David about the death of Saul and the death of Jonathan. So even though it didn't sound like it, by the time it gets translated in English, it doesn't sound like it should be music, but it was. It was a song that David wrote for the entire kingdom to sing with him. And he did this because he knew that there was something bigger than his victory over Saul. He knew that there was the integrity of the kingdom. He knew that there was humanity at stake here. And most importantly, even though he was in a bitter conflict with Saul, he loved Saul. He was his king. And he loved Jonathan. In fact, he loved Jonathan so much that David says in this reading we just heard that my love for you surpasses my love for women. Now we know, if you've read more of this story of Samuel, that David loved women a lot. In fact, we'll be reading a little bit more about that, exactly how much he loved women. So for him to say something like that really means something. It may or may not mean what our minds go to, what we think it could mean, that there was something physical going on between David and Jonathan, and certainly many scholars think so. It's possible that that's exactly what was going on. But interestingly, I think what's more important to that, whether that aspect of it is true or not, what's more important is that in the time of David, people tended not to marry for love in the first place. Their marriages were arranged. They married people who were suitable for them. And then they had relationships with people who satisfied their lust. But the notion of marrying for love, the idea that you would look to a woman for that type of relationship, maybe not as common as it is in our own time. And maybe we shouldn't be so surprised to find that he found it in his friend Jonathan. And that's the kind of love, that depth of love and commitment that he brought to this lament, to this song of sorrow that he was expressing to the whole country of Israel. In this moment of triumph, just like in A Few Good Men, in this moment when he could have been claiming, ha ha, I beat that king and now I'm the king, instead, he is mourning the loss of his enemy. He is mourning the loss of the person who is trying to keep him from taking the throne. This lament, this book that of Samuel that was written some time later, was written for the Jews during their captivity in Babylon. It was written as a song of hope, as a tale of hope to people who had lost everything. They had lost their position. They had lost their land. They had lost their homes. And they were taken away as prisoners to a foreign land, and their king was dead. And so the writer of the first and second book of Samuel was assuring them, God's people have been through this before as a people. And the point he was trying to express as David sings this song to his people is that everything you had hoped for may seem to be gone, and maybe it is, but God is putting a new future in front of you. David sings and he invites the kingdom to sing with him. And the loss that they share together, their common grief, transcends politics and war. As always, the value of our understanding the person of David, this King David who lived centuries ago, who in some way is pretty irrelevant to our common understanding of who we are, the reason that we still read about David to this day is because he was the first biblical character with whom we can truly relate. He's no Adam and Eve. He's no Moses. He's no Abraham. He's no Noah. He's not one of these kind of mythic, epic characters who seems to have very little in common with you and me. Instead, he is truly one of us. Yeah, he might be a king, but let's face facts. Right around here at St. Margaret's, this is no ordinary congregation. And many of you, in your own contexts, in your work environments, in your families, in your relationships with other people, you are used to being the big cheese. You are used to casting a big vision and being leaders of other people. And, like David, many of you are used to loss. Many of you have seen failure. Many of you have seen betrayal, either at your own hands or at the hands of those you love. So this character, David, teaches us a great deal about what it's like to be human. All the greatness to which David aspires, all the hopes that God has for David as God has for us, combined with all the foibles, all the screw-ups, all the errors, all the failures, and all the loss. So he can relate to you and me. He knows the greatness of God's promise and the sting and pain at his own failure and the loss of those he loves. Now, in our own lifetimes, we as a people in the United States have known huge change and known periods of huge loss and huge turmoil. And sometimes what comes as change that opens us up to fuller life looks at the time like loss. In 1963, when the civil rights movement was in full swing, President Kennedy had traveled to Dallas and was killed by an assassin's bullet. And it shocked our country because we saw it. And we can still see it today. You could call it up on your computer at home and see the event happen over and over. And the people sat transfixed as they watched the funeral on television. And almost no one had ever seen something like that before, because any presidential death prior to that had never been covered on television. And so those of us who had never seen such a spectacle observed a riderless horse walk through the streets of Washington, D.C., and a cortege carrying the body of the president and the family of the president walking behind, and the whole country mourned together. And if you believe that our politics are hot today, trust me, in 1963, they were red hot. And the people of the country came together and put aside what was different for them out of their common humanity, because there were issues at stake that were much bigger than our political opinions. What was at stake was, what does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean to be a child of God? And what are we to make out of this future that we thought was going to look one way and we knew was now going to look very different? Well, the civil rights movement followed that, and it wasn't long until 1965 when the Civil Rights Act passed, and then it wasn't long till after that in 1968 when Martin Luther King was himself gunned down. And again, a nation who was just barely beginning to recover from the Kennedy assassination mourned again the loss of Martin Luther King, a man who invited us as a people to see with a mind of imagination and hope a world that we didn't live in yet, but that God was preparing for us. A prophet who put in front of us a vision of who we could be as a people suddenly was gone. And the fear the people felt at the time, and the loss. But again, as they gathered around their televisions, they came together as a people the way the people of Israel came when they sang with King David. And they considered with fresh eyes again what it means to be human and children of God. That was a period of huge change, but it wasn't over. The Vietnam War raged into the late 60s and early 70s, And America sent its brightest and its best to Vietnam to be slaughtered by the thousands. And the people of our country wondered when it would be over. But we didn't want to watch this on television. We didn't want to think about it. And in fact, at the time that they were trying to figure out what kind of monument to erect in Washington, D.C., finally the realization was that a monument wasn't appropriate. Instead, a gash, a deep, dark gash in the green of the lawn was constructed, and the names of the silent fallen written onto the wall. And the people who visit that space come together and find meaning and find depth and understanding. But that was different, because not everybody goes there, and not everyone wants to know. And as the veterans who returned from Vietnam know, not everybody wanted to hear the story. It was a period of huge change, but it wasn't the last we would see. During the administration of Ronald Reagan, who had succeeded Carter and Ford, and the first president who ever resigned, Richard Nixon, that event spelling the end of the faith in our political process for so many people. Under Reagan's administration, the Soviet Union fell, and the Berlin Wall fell, and Berlin became one city, and the people rushed from one side to the other in both directions, and families were reunited, and people who had a shared culture and shared values and shared purpose came together again. But it was terrifying, because the intervening years had brought division, and the reunion brought chaos. And in the case of the Soviet Union, many people feared desperately what would happen to the nuclear weapons held by the Soviet Union. Into whose hands would they fall, and what would happen next? How would the balance of power and detente and mutually assured destruction, all of that, how would that settle out again in a new world order? And we all watched it together on television. And we celebrated, but we also feared together. It was not the first time or the last that we endured huge change. For example, on Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, planes crashed in Pennsylvania, crashed into the Pentagon, and bored holes into the World Trade Center and ultimately brought them down. And the death and the panic was overwhelming. And it was so unexpected. I remember on that day as I was driving into work and my wife called me and told me what had happened, and I didn't believe her, because that just cannot happen. And it wasn't until I saw it for myself that I started to believe, but even seeing the images, I thought, no, because that just can't happen. And I think a lot of us were that way. And as a country, we grieved that event together. Many of us didn't entirely know what to do, how to be, what we were supposed to do in this new world order when there was an eerie silence in the sky because no planes were flying and we could see the contrails of surveillance planes way, way up high. But that was all. And we knew that our lives were never going to be the same again. And I remember watching television shows like Saturday Night Live, and they didn't know what to do. They didn't know if it was okay to be funny ever again. New Yorkers didn't know how to be New Yorkers, and Americans didn't know how to be Americans. And we came into a period again of a heightened awareness that our politics may be different, but that didn't matter nearly as much as what united us. Our status, of course, as American citizens, but even more important, our status as human beings, as fellow souls, as children of God. This type of grief transcends everyday loss because so many people mourn, not just a loss of what had been in the past. People mourn the loss of a future that now could no longer be. The future that we thought not only was different than we thought, but the future that we thought we were going to have was no longer possible. Airline travel, for example, will never be the same. Really nothing will ever be the same. And the kingdom, whether it's our kingdom or David's, doesn't matter in that moment because our humanity is exposed and bared to ourselves and bared to each other. And our questions about who we are and who God is are laid bare for examination. And in those moments, we can handle the truth with humility and understanding. Because we've done it before, and it won't be the last time. This week, we endured it again. Great victory, great pain, all in the same week. The Supreme Court released several landmark decisions, including the holding up the Affordable Care Act and affirming that millions of people who had no access to health care now can get basic services that they need, that we can behave as if we respect the dignity of every human being in our own country and offer basic services like health care. And the Supreme Court also affirmed marriage equality throughout the United States and said that people have a right to marry any person that they choose at any place in the United States, and that those marriages would be recognized by every state in the country. This is a source of enormous celebration for so many of us. And yet, there are some who experience this as shock and fear and anxiety and even destruction. And our tendency to want to celebrate is tempered by our remembrance of the enormous loss of the people who never knew that kind of love, the people who never knew David's love for Jonathan, whatever its form, the people who had to keep their own loves secret, the people whose loves were discovered and they were killed for it, and the people who gave up in fear because the price was simply too high for them to love. And so our celebration is tempered. And like David, we don't gloat. Because, in part because this same week, we've seen violence from a group called ISIS in Tunisia, in France, and in Kuwait. Senseless destruction, loss of life, terrible, terrible behavior. And that's still something that we're dealing with now. This week, our President Barack Obama offered a eulogy at the funeral of the Reverend Clementa Pinckney and eight others at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, where the nine of them were gunned down by a man who hated them simply because they were black people, gathered for prayer, gathered under the name of Jesus. And the president said, "To the families of the fallen, this nation shares in your grief. Our pain cuts that much deeper because it happened in a church. The church," he said, "is and always has been the center of African American life, a place to call our own in a too often hostile world, a sanctuary from so many hardships." And, like King David, Obama sang and invited the congregation and the country to sing with him. At first, people laughed a little bit because they weren't sure where he was going. Did he really seriously expect us to sing this together? And yes, he did. And yes, they did. And he sang the first verse of Amazing Grace. And he called the individual names of the fallen. And he said of each of them, they knew that amazing grace. David's singing may be a role model for our church, writes Bruce Birch. The church, he says, should be the place where death can be faced for the painful reality that it is, and where our human loss and grief can be voiced. It should be a place where we dare to speak of kingdoms we hoped for, that have suffered defeat and have left us despairing of justice or peace or hope. This is the point of the cross as a central symbol of the Christian faith, he says. The brokenness of our lives and our world must be acknowledged and voiced. David teaches us that we cannot move to joy, renewal, and praise too soon. We must make a place for our pain. Our words cannot heal if they are not exposed. Our wounds cannot heal if they're not exposed. It is only after encounter with the cross and the loss it represents that resurrection can speak a meaningful word of life. The poetry of pain and grief allows the lost kingdom of Saul to give way to the renewed kingdom of David. The church can sing with David and become a place where pain and loss are acknowledged publicly and their power over us is broken. This can enable a turning toward God's new future for ourselves, for our nation, and for the world. All of us in this place have known pain and loss. And to some extent, we've known it together. And I believe that we at St. Margaret's can steer into that pain, into that new vision that God places in front of us that is greater than we can ask or imagine. I believe we can handle the truth. Amen.